This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Central Ward, cabinet member for Transport and Energy, Kai Dudd. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Christian Zionist Mike Pompeo from the US State Department has been over in the UK. His only policy really seems to be blaming the rest of the world for the US government's failings. And like a mad dog, threatening with sanctions or war every country that pursues its own policies. So it's trade war with China and a nuclear-powered Nimitz-class carrier strike forces chugging off on the long voyage to the Persian Gulf. Welcome, Mike Pompeo. In Westminster. We hear him and also some voices from Tehran tonight, from the University of Tehran, and also Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, who I've never seen on the BBC. They're threatening to resume uranium enrichment if the EU starts sanctions, as the US is trying to force them to. Plus, Zionist shock jock Alex Jones interviews Nigel Farage. Israel again bombards Gaza. And finally, how can we reform the United Nations to actually ensure its own charter, which bans the sorts of war of aggression and invasion that Mike Pompeo's planning? That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows around 7 Celsius and dry this weekend. Highs around 16, sunny spells all weekend. Next week, highs around 16, plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 18th and 19th of May, a little bit cooler, highs around 14, patchy rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So make the most of the weather this weekend. So joining me to review this week's news is Labour councillor for Central Ward, cabinet member for Transport and Energy, Kai Dudd. Hi, Kai. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
So energy and transport. Is that how long have you been doing both of those for? Is it just transport you picked up more recently?
Yeah, I picked up transport a couple of months ago. And then previously, I was doing waste management and energy, and also regulatory services as well. So I think energy and transport are quite a good fit. So I asked to keep energy. I think that's a...
So, but you get paid for doing two separate jobs or only for one?
No, you just get paid once.
Okay. Well, this is a good way for Marvin to save a few bob, isn't it?
Yeah. Doubling
up. Yeah. So, okay. So let's start with energy. Bristol Energy has been a disaster, hasn't it?
No, I don't.
Are you still putting money into it?
I disagree with that. I think it's got a very, very bright future. You know, we're doing a great project at the moment called the City Leap Energy Programme, where we're trying to attract billions of pounds into the city to invest in energy infrastructure.
But, about 40 million, I think, of taxpayers' money gone into it. How much has come out of Bristol Energy?
Well, it was always an investment that was sort of a medium term investment. It was never expected to make money straight away, but there it's on track to return money back to the taxpayer of Bristol. And more so once we get the City Leap Energy project off the ground.
So what is this project? Tell us about
it. Yeah, so the City Leap Energy project, back in the summer, we developed a prospectus of investable energy opportunities in the city around the decarbonising agenda, so solar, wind, district heating systems, hydrogen. We put that out around the world, and we've had 180 expressions of interest from around the world, from Japan, China, USA, from Europe, from interest in this country, about organisations that want to come and partner with us in Bristol to decarbonise the energy infrastructure in Bristol. And Bristol Energy is very much part of that So at the moment, it's an energy retail company. And what it will also move into as part of this project is energy servicing, where margins are much higher. So it's got quite a bright future.
But Kai, you haven't really persuaded enough Bristol people to buy into it, have you, to get their energy from them rather than one of the big commercial providers who are cheaper?
The numbers are sort of on track. I think the problem in the energy market is around margins, actually. Just plain energy reselling is a very tough game to be in. But as I said, Bristol Energy is going to go into energy servicing as well now, and the margins are going to be much higher, and it's going to be a firm part of this.
So what does that mean, energy servicing?
Oh, so it's things like smart energy technology, metering,
boilers. Smart meters. Hang on, just a minute. Smart meters. I keep getting my provider phoning me up every few weeks saying, you've got to have a smart meter. I'm not going to have a smart meter because I don't want a smart meter for a very particular reason, and that is that I don't want someone to be able to remotely hack my smart meter and turn off my electricity.
To find out when when you're putting the kettle on and stuff like that.
Well, it's not so much that. It's that these things are not secure. We're told it's going to be smart, it's going to be wonderful, it's going to be brilliant, a smart city, but it's all hackable.
Well, for example, there's a pilot project going on in Eastern at the moment around smart energy technology, around the domestic washing machine. So you've got a piece of software that regulates when the washing machine turns on and off, and it picks up the supply of energy when the demand is low on the network. So people save money because they're using energy when it's cheap. So it's technology like that we're promoting in Bristol. And Bristol Energy's got a role in that, around metering, around payments, around servicing, around the servicing of assets. And that's the way to go in terms of energy. That's where the margins are, not energy reselling.
So is there anything else you're onto with regards to energy in the city? Because this is, I mean, you're the sort of man to implement all the changes because of the climate change agenda, are you? To try and make sure that Bristol is carbon neutral.
Yeah, of course. I mean, obviously, you've got transport. That's a major part of the problem we're facing. And you've got the energy system. They're the two key issues when we talk about decarbonising the energy system. So I think we'll make massive strides on the energy system through the City Leap energy programme. And transport's more difficult. And then you've got what some people are calling scope free, which is sort of the manufacture of goods and the production of goods, which as the city of Bristol, we probably don't have complete control over. But we can look at things through our procurement processes and things like that as Bristol City Council, and as also working with the city partners like the NHS, the universities, about how we procure goods and how they're made and what comes into the city. So it's more of a soft power.
When it comes to transport, the obvious, surely, Labour Party solution, Martin Summers, is what Ken Livingstone tried to do in the 1980s, which is to help subsidise public transport in one way or another through the rates it used to be, now it'd be council tax, in order to just basically make it so cheap and easy to use public transport that people leave their cars at home or even sell them.
Well, I mean, if the Bristol City Council had the power, it could move in that direction, but you've got to recognise that local authorities, in fact, don't have a great deal of power in this area. It's Tim... What's the Metro Mayor's second name?
Bowles,
yes. I mean, he's the one who can decide to bring in franchising, which they've got in London. And, of course, in London, they never completely privatised the transport network because they knew it would be chaotic. It was chaotic everywhere else. But they knew if they did it in London, posh people would realise how chaotic it was, so they never went there and they kept the franchising structure in place. But of course, they prevented Ken Livingstone from subsidising London transport to the extent he was on the grounds.
Franchising's not the silver bullet.
No, it's not a silver bullet either. I mean, what you really need is to go back to having it nationally planned. Yeah. I mean, it's an obvious thing.
There's a story in the Post this week. Labour wants to help Mayor Marvin Rees set up a Bristol-run bus company. Mr Rees said a council-owned bus company or franchise could reduce car dependency. Well, this sounds like a move in the right direction. Yeah. Future Labour government would give Bristol's mayor, and presumably not just Marvin, other mayors around the country, the cash needed to run a city-owned bus company. Andy McDonald, Labour's Shadow Transport Secretary, said fresh funding announced by the opposition party would be put towards creating a city-run bus franchise or municipal, the type operated in places like Nottingham and Reading. Well, if they can do it in Nottingham and Reading already, Kai, why not here?
Well, it's I think it's legacy. They never sold off their bus company in the first place. They kept theirs. And if you look at the public satisfaction around bus services, those are some of the highest places in the country where people are happy with their buses. So it's much more difficult to start from scratch. And there's a lot of regulation in the way of actually setting up a bus company. But I think it's a great idea. And I'd rather go down that route than a franchising route where you guarantee the profit of a private contractor that comes in to run a route. And I suppose there is an element of competition when you put the route out to tender that other bus companies can bid against each other. But when they undercut each other, what are they undercutting on? There's very few things that you can better the margin on. And we've seen in London where there's been lots of industrial relations issues where you've got bus drivers working for TfL contracted out to a number of companies, and they're all paid different amounts of money for doing the same job. And I think for me that's an unacceptable situation. I wouldn't want to see that.
I mean, from
Bristol.
An economics point of view, Martin, this whole business of bus running a bus company doesn't really work with having competitive tendering for these various bus routes, because if someone tenders low, then they find they can't make any money, and then they have to stop the bus route, and then it has to be tendered out again to somebody else. It just doesn't seem to fit with this whole idea of the principle of tendering services out doesn't work.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, it was quite clear after privatisation of the buses in the 1980s, and all the studies that were done at university level showed that it didn't work and it cost more and it was a more inefficient way to do it. But you've got to remember, there's been an ideology of privatisation in this country for a whole generation, and we have 13 years of Labour government where they could have changed all of that, but they didn't. And that's one of the reasons why there's been rebellion in the grassroots of the Labour Party against what used to go on, because we've just got used to having second, third rate stuff in this country, and we just get used to it. If you go to other countries like Sweden or whatever, they just laugh at the way we run things.
Okay,
it's just stupid.
On transport, most people are pretty annoyed with the fact that Bristol's one of the most congested cities in the country. Some say in Europe. What are you doing about it?
So the main focus at the moment is on buses. So Bristol's actually, despite the headlines, seen a massive growth in bus use, growth of 40% over the last 5 years in the numbers of people using buses. And what we're trying to do is to get that to double again up to, so at the moment it's 11% of journeys to work. What we want to do is get that up to 20% of journeys to work. What we're working on at the moment is a bus deal where, as Bristol City Council and the West of England, we'll improve bus priority, more bus lanes, priority at junctions, and in return the bus company, which is First Bus at the moment, unfortunately in Bristol, they'll promise to double the number of buses on the road and also clean up the bus fleet as well with biogas buses.
Well,
so that's what we're trying to pursue at the moment within the framework that we're working in.
Now, one of the we talked about smart meters a minute ago.
Yeah.
Smart ticketing is one of the big things the First Group are pushing. And, I mean, we have discussed this previously when these Metrobus first came in. But now there are two different apps you can download, which where you can buy your... I don't know if you've done this, Kai, have you? One is called the First Bus, Bus Travel and Times, which you can also use to buy bus tickets on. And there's another one called First Bus M Tickets. Now, the only problem is that the reviews for these apps are universally horrendous.
Okay.
The most recent one for the M-Ticket app says very poor functionality. Many times I've tried to activate the ticket, but the app crashes each time a ticket is selected before activation. Tickets also expire from my wallet a few days after the app is opened and closed, despite the expiry date. I mean, he's saying he's lost money here using that app, so it's probably better to use cash. I mean, there's a whole load here, and I'll put a link up on our show page to those apps, because you can download them and have all the frustrations that these people have had. Joshua, the next guy, it's nice I can have lots of tickets on my phone, but the app crashes all the time.
Okay.
The other app is the more recent one, First Bus, Bus Travel and Times app. Equally, but it's even worse rating. The app would not open the ticket wallet. If I hadn't had cash to pay the walk-on fare, I'd have been stranded, says someone else. Sean Butler says, horrific support if you have an issue from First Bus. App has logged me out and wouldn't accept my username and password. I've been a user for years now, and the password resync link doesn't generate any email. I raised a ticket 2 days ago and haven't had a reply for them. My money has been wasted. So this is the sort of... I mean, these are... Okay. And I'm not kidding. These are the only app. But basically, it's one star.
Right.
So the thing is, Kai, I'm not blaming you for this. This is First Group. So you're trying to pursue a transport policy with a private company that's coming up with these horrendous app reviews.
Yeah, I mean, I've got the app on my phone, the M-Ticket one, and yeah, sometimes it is a bit slow, and it cuts out and things like that. One thing I would say on the positive side is there's been a massive uptake in people using the app. So I think I was talking to James Freeman, the managing director of First Bus in Bristol, and I think he said about 60% of passengers now use the app. So there's been a massive uptake in it, so it looks as though people are voting with their feet in terms of downloading it and using it.
Well, they're doing it because they want to get a cheaper fare, and they get a cheaper fare through the app. But for certainly the first 9 most recent reviews
where's that come from?
On Google Play. The 9 most recent are all 1-star and all complaints.
And what's the app got overall?
It's got overall, good question, it's got it's too far down to see it.
Yeah.
Oh dear, I think it's 3.
She was have to look at the average,
five.
Didn't you, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's pretty poor for
anyway,
an app, isn't
it's
it?
Saying it's
going, I mean, that's something I can take up with First Group.
It's going down, yeah.
Obviously, I don't control First Group, but it's something I can talk to them about and use that soft power that we've got.
The new app is 3.1. Rated at 3.1.
I mean, that's bad for an app, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
terrible. That's bad for an app.
It means that they haven't really tested the app.
That's something
we'll
take up.
Other than that, surely there must be a way to get these cars off the road, Kai. If the buses were really as good as you say they are, then we wouldn't be having so many cars.
I'm not saying the bus system in Bristol's good, but as I said, there's been a massive growth in bus use compared to other cities. Where it's in some cities it's declining, and what we're working
that's
on
students is it because we're going to be increasing students too, aren't we?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so it's maybe students are using the bus, but what we want to do is improve bus priority, so buses aren't stuck in traffic jams across the city. They've got there's going to be more bus lanes in Bristol, more priority junctions. So we want to make buses the best way to get around the city. That's a real ambition, and I think the only way you do that is by putting the infrastructure into the city, really.
How about Metrobus? That's not exactly been the most sort of silver bullet that it was being touted. I mean, it was a painful birth, wasn't it, over about 4 or 5 years. And now, what's it actually doing?
I mean, the line out to Uwe is very, very good, well used, very quick.
Students again?
Exactly. Students are benefiting mainly, but obviously you've got workers that come into Bristol from Emerson's Green and places like that. The route out to, where are we talking about? Ashton Vale, some issues with that. Obviously, it doesn't operate on a Sunday at the moment. And then the route out to Hengrove is from people I've been talking to. They're very pleased with it. I've got a colleague, a good friend that lives up in Knowle, and he often gets he goes down to Temple Meads, and it takes him 12 minutes from Knowle West to get to Temple Meads. And he says it's brilliant. So I think it's a mixed bag, and it can be improved. But I think the idea of a highly segregated bus service that's where the bus has got lots of priority is the way to go to improve the bus service in Bristol.
But you can't use cash on it, can you?
Well, I'll let you into a bit of a secret. First Bus will actually take cash on those services, but the whole point of that is to move away from cash, so the bus is not stuck at a bus stop where someone's counting out, £3, £4 in 5p pieces. It's about speeding the buses up.
Okay, so actually, if you're really desperate, you can pay by cash, so you won't be stranded.
No, so if imagine we've got an old lady. We're not going to leave an old lady stranded on a bus because she's got a bag full of change and she isn't.
I mean, most people think, the drivers don't even carry a cash float. So
no,
that's good.
I mean, that is part of the problem, but the idea is to move away from cash for the reasons of speed.
If I was the first bus boss...
So if people were advertising, well, actually, we do take cash.
If I was the first bus boss, I'd say, well, we've got no change. You can give us a fiver or a tenner, but I'm afraid there's no change. Yeah. Anyway, this whole move towards the cashless society, this is something, again, which goes with your kind of smart city agenda. I'm, again, railing against that to a certain extent because I thought it'd be interesting to have a listen to... there's a chap called Brett Scott online, who is a journalist, writes on financial issues, and he thinks there's actually quite a sinister agenda trying to get rid of cash. Now, obviously, it makes the buses go quicker if you've got a little app, fine. But to actually say, you know, no, you're not allowed to use cash, we've just had the local government in San Francisco say that that shops, if they want to trade in San Francisco, are not allowed to be cashless only. So they have to be able to accept cash as well. So there's a trend in the States which has been sort of trying to go for the cashless society, and San Francisco is a city that's now said, no, we're not having that. We want people, if they've got cash, you've got to accept that cash as a payment. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a brief description of why Brett Scott thinks that the whole cashless society thing is a bad idea.
And there's also all the companies that work around the banks, like the payments companies like Visa and MasterCard, who facilitate the movement of money between bank accounts. Then there's the fintech industry more generally, or the financial technology industry, who often then builds more services on top of it. So you can imagine these layers of the digital financial ecosystem. There's the banks, who are the sort of underlying layer. Then there's the payments companies and the fintech companies that are built on top of that. And all of them have agendas in pushing for cashless society, because cash represents a form of payment that they don't make any fees from. Then governments are also pushing for it, because you can monitor what goes on between bank accounts a lot more easily than you can monitor cash transactions. So there's a bunch of government agendas around being able to essentially have greater levels of surveillance upon society, but also to, you know, there's monetary policy agendas that the government has by being able to control the money supply more easily. Those are the main players pushing for it right now. What the technology industry often will do is to speak about a future that they would like to see and present it as being completely inevitable and obvious that it will happen. All right, so a lot of the sort of tech futurism is really the sort of desires of technology companies projected out as being obvious things that will supposedly will happen. So when people are saying, you know, we're inevitably moving towards a cashless society, we're inevitably going to this, it's largely the marketing departments of the financial technology companies that are trying to create this sense that this was what you want, right? So, and this is why the companies like Visa, for example, will be running all their adverts all the time in London saying, you know, cash-free and proud. You know, they're trying to engineer this feeling that there's something wrong with cash. I mean, cash is a public utility, right? Anybody can use it. There's no requirement to be interacting with a private company in order to be using cash. Whereas private companies have to advertise and make themselves desirable, which is why they're on this kind of offensive against cash, on private payments companies. But yes, the financial technology industry more generally has a lot of agendas in trying to tell us that there's this inevitable automation and digitalization of finance. FinTech is a sector, which stands for financial technology. Basically, FinTech is the automation of finance. I mean, that's what the financial technology industry does. And there's sort of two big sections to FinTech. One is trying to automate the jobs of financial professionals. So, say, take something that previously a banker would have had to do manually and just automate it. So, for example, automating a loan decision-making process. So rather than a bank actually deciding whether a loan is going to be granted, just have it through some algorithm that decides. That's an example of a type of a fintech innovation, and it's the automation of a financial professional. The other sort of section of that is the automation of the user experience layer of finance. So that's the kind of like front end, you know, how the branches, the places where you go and interact with the financial sector. So they will try to replace a branch with a phone app, or try to replace any kind of analog form with some kind of automated digital form. So the end goal of the financial technology sector is to automate both the financial professionals and how you interact with them. And that's what they would call digital banking, digital finance, digital payments, and they all kind of interact together to create, that's the fintech sector.
That's Brett Scott there. He's the author of The Heretic's Guide to Global Finance, Martin.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, when we're talking about buses earlier, you could make buses free. in which case you wouldn't have any financial exchange taking place. And you could do, I mean, look at the National Health Service. People don't actually go into a hospital and make financial transactions.
Well, that's bad for GDP.
Well, no, it's not, because it all happens anyway. It's just that you provide it for free. Free is cheaper. And ultimately, a socialist society will provide a lot of things for free. Education, healthcare, transport, all free. And that's a big chunk of the economy. Probably more than half of it, and no transactions need to take place at all if you move in that direction.
What about this idea of automating loans and things like that?
Well, the problem with that is, as we've seen, that the algos are now deciding what happens in the stock market, because, you know, basically the computers
decide.
This has
been happening for at least 20 years, actually.
But of course, what happens then is when the stock market system is under pressure, the algos decide to dump everything all at once, and there's nobody unless you pull the plug on the computer.
If you talk to anyone that's written software,
it's all going to go down the road.
If you talk to anyone that's written software to do stock trading, you'll find that there are all sorts of safeguards built into it.
Yeah, they claim. But when you actually reach the point of the safeguards and the algos, they're all based within certain parameters.
Anyway, can I just ask Kai about this whole concept of if you apply for a loan and it's basically like an algorithm, artificial intelligence deciding whether you get your money or not, Kai?
Yeah, you'll have to explain that one to me. That seems quite dangerous, doesn't it? So I go online and say, can I have 10 grand? And an algorithm says, yeah, you can. Is that what you're saying?
It might well be that you actually speak to a human being.
Okay.
And it says, well, come back to you tomorrow. And it's actually a computer that's looked at you, checked your financial records or something, and they come back, or who knows what they checked, and they just come back and say, sorry, no. They don't give you an explanation. Well, I mean, certainly in China, one of the sorts of things that they will be looking into is your social credit rating.
What's known as sustainable finance, is it?
Yes. If we... well, maybe. It certainly won't be employing very many people. But the idea being that you just get told yes or no based on what a computer says, and you've got no real access to way to check what the computer's saying. It just sounds like a bit of a bizarre way to do things.
No, I totally agree. I mean... Yeah, what more can you say to that, really?
Well, I just add to that. The thing is, they're more likely to push loans on you that you shouldn't be given, yeah? Because, don't forget, they're in the business of selling money. The other thing that should be mentioned in this context is that Narendra Modi, there's an ongoing general election going on in India. It goes on for about a month. But he's on his back feet because he was pressured by USAID and by the American government to get rid of all high denomination cash in India. And don't forget that most people in India haven't got bank accounts. To try and get rid of cash in India was an extraordinary kind of thing to attempt. And of course, it smashed local small businesses, tea sellers, people driving taxis and so on were completely smashed by it. So it's made him. It's actually made his re-election much more difficult than it otherwise would be.
Apply to the banks to start a socialist transport campaign and see if they give you any money. I bet they don't.
No. I'm sure the algorithm will say no to that.
No, definitely no. Yeah. Also this week, on the subject of Brexit, we've had Prince Charles over in Germany, effectively, although, you know, you have to read between the lines a little bit, saying, yes, I'm of German heritage and we've got to retain our ties with the EU. Now, this, I only mention because the monarchy is supposed to not get involved in things like this. In fact, when there were rumours in The Sun that the Queen was supported Brexit, there was a big hoo-ha about it and complete denials. So there seems to be a little bit of a difference, Kai, in what we were getting in the old school with Queen Elizabeth, and the new generation of Prince Charles is actually starting to weigh in a little bit more on these political issues. And I wonder what you make of that, whether they think it's appropriate.
Well, I'm not really a fan of the monarchy, to be honest with you. And you're right, they should stay out of politics if this country is going to have a monarchy. I actually thought it was the other way around, that the Queen was being seen as supporting a softer type Brexit deal, to be honest with you, rather than a... I mean, it's all cryptic and coded, and people can read it in whatever way they want. Does that mean Prince Charles wants a soft Brexit? Does it mean he's against Brexit totally? Probably doesn't mean he wants a hard Brexit, does it?
No, probably not. But he's certainly saying it in Germany, and he's saying it to an audience which is an international audience about the EU, Martin. I mean, is it appropriate, do you think, he agrees with you, but should he be saying it?
Well, no, I mean, the thing about Prince Charles is on some issues I agree with him, on some issues I don't agree with him, but frankly, he's too... he shouldn't be involved in that at that level. But don't forget, I suppose he would spin it by saying, look, whether we're in or out of the EU, we're just trying to reassure the Germans that we're going to carry on being friends with them, not least because we are actually the Saxe-Coburg-Gothas originally, and of course in World War One they changed their name to the Windsors because they were in fact German. They are a German royal family brought from Hanover.
Battenbergs.
Yes,
well, that's right. Main Batten.
That's right.
Yeah,
indeed. And of course, Prince Charles. Prince Philip went to an SS school. Mm. He used to wear an SS uniform at school, but of course, he's a very loyal British citizen these days.
Also, this week, Prince Charles in news again. Reason I mentioned this time is because actually this is really about Highgrove, which is up near Tetbury, which is Prince Charles's official residence, mm-hmm. and not far from here, and his relationship with the Bishop of Gloucester, a guy called Peter Ball. And this is in the Daily Mirror. This week, Prince Charles's friendship with the paedophile clergyman was misguided. Peter Ball used his friendship with the Prince of Wales to further his campaign to return to unrestricted ministry. Now, to cut a long story short, effectively Peter Ball was taken away because of the from his ministry as a bishop because of these various allegations against him. But then Prince Charles put pressure on to get him back in. It turns out that he actually was a paedophile, and so this pressure from Prince Charles was totally inappropriate. In 2015, Peter Ball, now 87, got 32 months in jail after being convicted of sexual offences against 17 teenagers and young men, one of whom took his own life. So Prince Charles is a little bit misguided, it seems, in being sort of pally and putting pressure on for this guy to get his job back, Martin.
Well, there's a report that's come out this week which has said he was basically misguided.
This is one of the latest weeks of this what they call a national inquiry into child sexual abuse.
Well, yes, and of course the other thing, of course, was his great friendship with Jimmy Savile, which went on for years and years and years. And I'm sure there's plenty more in that particular can of worms to come out.
This obsession with paedophilia amongst the elite, Martin, it just seems as, you know, this has been going on for years. What's it really all about?
Well, look, underlying all of this, I'm always mentioning this context, the King Cora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, which is, there's been investigations going on there. MI5 were using that as a honey trap. So basically they were getting politicians and loyalist paramilitary leaders in there. They were having sex with underage boys, and then they were being blackmailed, basically. And I don't think that was just going on at King Cora. People who were in King Cora at the time have testified that they were taken all over the country. So basically the intelligence services have always used paedophilia as a means of blackmail. And if you think about the culture of MI6 in particular, you've got all these and don't forget that you know, homosexuality was illegal for under 21s and then completely illegal in the 50s, but the culture of MI6 was very much public school. They were very accepting of homosexuality, but of course they then became accepting of basically child abuse, and that's part of the internal culture, and they use it as a means of blackmailing politicians. That's what they do, and they've been doing it for years.
Kai, what do you make of this? Are we ever going to get to the bottom of this? Because it seems to be dragging on for years and years, and yet still there are, some people get put in jail, but it seems there's still some problem out there. I mean, we were looking recently at things like Greville Janner and various other people who were accused, Cyril Smith, and there certainly were very strong allegations against them, which were then swept under the carpet. I mean, do you think we're actually? I mean, one of the things that puzzles me about this, a fundamental thing, is this going on all over the world, and the Brits are just the first people to start to get to grips with it? What do you think?
I mean, obviously, it seems to be the case that, you know, people have got away with it, and there seems to be some sort of some people say cover up, don't they? In terms of to protect certain individuals. We've also seen some people have been convicted, haven't they? Mainly celebrities rather than politicians. So people like Rolf Harrison have obviously been convicted. But it seems those sort of more closely linked to the establishment have either sort of died and then it's come out afterwards, like Jimmy Savile and Cyril Smith. A case has collapsed and there's not been enough evidence. So there does seem to be something going on, but obviously I don't know all the details of that.
We've had some convictions of detectives today, Martin, who just were apparently too lazy to even bother to investigate these. I mean, these are serious crimes. People can go to jail for you know, 10, 15 years, 20 years for these crimes, and yet the detectives said, oh, I couldn't be bothered to investigate it.
Well, I don't know enough about that particular case, but as you say, they've been sent down by the courts today for malfeasance in public office, I think it was. I think I'll come back to my initial point.
Yeah, this is a form of misconduct in public office where the other police have proved that these police were deliberately sabotaging what they were supposed to do as part of their job as a public official. So it's Essex police officers. They forged documents and hid evidence out of cynical disdain. These detectives were jailed today for sabotaging child abuse investigations. Two former detective constables jailed for sabotaging child abuse investigations out of laziness for vulnerable and disdain for vulnerable victims. Charon Patterson, 49, and Lee Pollard, 47, forged documents, concealed evidence and lied about investigations. The pair were sentenced to 18 months and 2 years in prison respectively.
Yeah, and don't forget, we've had an ex-Met police officer on this programme, have we not, who said that when he tried to investigate the sort of elite paedophilia, he was basically warned off and basically forced out of the police force. And I suggest that all of this is not just because these are nasty people and they do nasty things and they're trying to cover it up. It's because there's been a policy of using it for blackmail. I think one of the Tory whips at one stage said, you know, one of the things we do is if they've been, you know, they've been caught in a public toilet with an underage boy, we can cover that up for them as long as they vote for the war in Iraq or whatever it is we want them
That's
to
right,
do.
That's right, we keep a note of it in a little black
book. We just
book.
Keep a little note of it. That's right.
It's a house of cards, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, this is real life. This is how it works. Yeah. And they've been doing it for years. King Corra is a very clear example. And they were trying to exclude Northern Ireland from this inquiry to begin with on the grounds that it wasn't part of the British jurisdiction. Should tell Gerry Adams that, because that's what he's been saying all along.
Well, as part of all of this, we've seen massive cuts in the police, of course, as well. 21,000 less police officers since 2010, and that came up in Prime Minister's questions this week.
Dr. Rupa Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. When 12-year-old Zach Gormley, a family friend, is the latest victim of an after-school mugging traumatising him, and in the same week another family is terrified by masked robbers in their own home, Leafy, Ealing and Chiswick feel like they're becoming the Wild West. The Prime Minister said austerity is over. So when will we get back the 21,000 police officers cut under her watch? 300 locals.
Lady knows that we're making around £1 billion extra available for police this year. That includes a significant amount of extra money that will be available for the Metropolitan Police. That extra money is being put into violence reduction units in hotspots around the country, which includes London, to ensure that we deal with this issue of serious violence, which the government takes very seriously and will be dealing with across in a number of ways and across government departments.
Of course, she doesn't there mention anything about actually increasing police numbers. She's talking about we will deal with violence. And she was Home Secretary before she became Prime Minister, Kai.
Well, I'm the councillor for the city centre, and it's a crime hotspot. It's one of the, I think it's the highest recorded crime in the Avon and Somerset area. I've had murders since I've been a councillor, one in Redcliffe. There's been two in Redcliffe, sexual assaults, serious muggings. And then you've got all the low-level crime as well, like theft and antisocial behaviour. And I've been out with police in my ward, and really, they don't have the resources to deal with the crime in front of them. Actually, they won't. If you see someone doing something they shouldn't be, the police won't go and tackle them because they don't really have the backup that they need to deal with that issue straight away. So they very much focus on only the very serious crime. And they need a lot of planning behind any action they take, so that they don't like to react to situations.
Well, some will say the police are just using this as an excuse to sit in their office and not go out on the front line. I mean, we just simply don't see police out on the streets anymore, doing the old sort of on the beat, or you know, was it point duty they used to call it?
Well, they do go out occasionally, but you're right. It's not like it used to be. And obviously, if you cut the police by that figure, it's going to have an effect. So it's a complete. Is a complete myth, really, to say that you can cut the numbers and it won't have an effect. It's got a clear effect on the level of crime and also the confidence that the people have got in how safe their streets are, how safe their communities are. I think that lack of visibility does affect that as well, the confidence that people have got.
Well, I mean, obviously, you should have said 21,000 police have been sacked since the austerity drive began. And, of course, the money was there. It just used to bail the banks out. And that's where it's gone. And everybody seems to think, well, there was no money, and that's why we had to cut the police. We shouldn't have cut the police. We should have actually beefed up the police fraud squad to bust the bankers, and then we could have taken all the money off them, not just the money they put into the banks, but you can actually confiscate their assets.
Well, actually, it was the former Met detective, Rowan Bosworth Davis, on this programme a few years ago, that said that his report to Andrew Tyree and the Treasury Select Committee was that the City of London is... fulfills all of the criteria, international criteria of organised crime.
Indeed.
Effectively, they are doing money laundering, they are doing false accounting, and they are really not interested in any kind of integrity, because they know they're not going to get prosecuted. That was what he said. As a detective, he was told, the word has come down from on high, no more prosecutions of blue blood bankers.
So what should have happened...
Bankers have gone to jail.
Well, none.
There you go.
So what should have happened is, when the banks were bailed out, you should have gone into the banks and arrested everybody responsible, sent them all to prison. It happened in 1980s in America during the savings and loan scandal. 1,000 bankers were sent to prison. You get the money off them, and then you don't have to cut the police force. So all this stuff, there's no money, we had to cut the police force. That's just wrong. We should have boosted up the police force. We should have put all the bankers in prison. We didn't do it.
Well,
you need to do it. It's not just wishful thinking. You've got to do it.
I heard a bit more this week about Thames Valley Police investigating Avon and Somerset Police over their failure to investigate Lloyds Bank at Castle Park, which is this organisation which has the accusation, and this isn't by me, this was by Anthony Stansfield, who's the Police and Crime Commissioner for Thames Valley. He reckons there's a £1 billion crime been going on and still going on at Lloyds Bank Castle Park, where they are basically getting people into new people who have got loans with them into new arrangements, and then using those new arrangements to put them into unpayable debt and taking off them, you know, enormous amounts of intellectual property and that sort of thing. So it could be, and we can't say it is. It'd be interesting to see if it ever goes to court, whether it is or not. It could be going on in Bristol right this minute, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the US economist, famous US economist, he's based in Austin, Texas. He's an expert on all of this. And basically, when you get a crash like we had in 2008, what should happen is you go in and you arrest everybody and you put them in prison. A, to deter any future malfeasance, and B, to cover your own costs.
Without a trial?
No, you put them in prison with a trial. Yeah, but what's happened in this country and elsewhere is, if they arrest anybody, they've got to arrest everybody. So they're not going to arrest everybody, so they don't arrest anybody. But that's what should have happened, and there shouldn't have been no cuts in police numbers at all. Because if you do that, you can claw all the assets back.
Isn't the other problem that banking's so complex that when cases do go to court, nobody's got a clue happened?
That's partly, and
you know, the judge doesn't know what's happened. The prosecution lawyers can't explain it correctly to a jury. The juries don't know what's happened.
That's what happened in the Blue Arrow trial, which Rowan Bosworth Davis, who was the chief fraud squad officer, was prosecuting. It took them years and years and years. They went after the top people.
This was
in the city.
Actually a tactic which was done by the defence and the judge to get rid of the jury. They said, oh, it's way too complicated, you can't understand it. Oh dear, and so there was no jury. And so, first of all, they were given a suspended sentence, then they appealed that, and they were acquitted, even of a suspended sentence, because they're blue blood bankers, and you can't put them.
Well, that's right. Now, we were talking about having third-rate bus services in this country. We've accepted that they're allowed to get away with it, and that's why we've got to cut police officers. And that's the poverty of the political debate.
Put a link up on our show page this week to Rowan's marvellous thing he wrote for the Treasury Select Committee, because it is a fascinating read.
He's
to
a criminologist
see exactly,
now, isn't he?
Yeah, he teaches.
Professor of criminology.
He's, I think, City University in London, but it's an interesting blog, that, an interesting submission, which, by the way, they said, oh, we didn't get your submission. He phoned them up a week afterwards, and he'd sent it by them, by registered post, and they refused to even admit that they got his submission, which said all these controversial things. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the Mayor, Marvin Rees. It's a pity he hasn't been on this programme. He doesn't want to come on this programme, and maybe, Kai, you can persuade him to one of these days. But he's got his question and answer session he did on Facebook last Thursday. He's talking about the congestion charge. Before we hear what Marvin has to say, Kai, what do you make of the congestion charge? This is a way, there's been quite a lot of pressure been put on your administration to start implementing a congestion charge here in Bristol, because it's a way of saying you're doing something about pollution.
Well, there's two issues, isn't there? There's a difference between a congestion charge and a clean air zone something that charges certain types of engines. So I think people need to be very clear about what they're asking and what problem they want a certain type of intervention to tackle. But any, in my view, any type of congestion zone needs to be linked to a major improvement in transport. So if we're going to bring in a mass transit system in Bristol with an underground, we can then bring in a congestion charge and link the money that comes in for a congestion charge to the new infrastructure that's been delivered.
How real is this Chinese money for this underground?
Well, you must know more than me. I've not heard about Chinese money in the underground.
Well, apparently, there might be some Chinese money coming in for it.
Please explain. Yeah,
apparently, or Malaysian, maybe.
Okay. So there's been two reports on the underground around the sort of geology and the feasibility. They've both come back quite positive. There's going to be a further report, a more detailed report that looks at the business case for an underground. I believe that's going to the next full committee at WECA to be agreed and signed off, the Western England Combined Authority. So the first two reports are quite promising. So it is something that's very possible in Bristol. And I think it's the kind of step change that the people of Bristol want.
Well, when are we looking at starting to stick spades in?
Yeah, it's not a short-term project. It's a long, medium to long-term, 10 to 15 years. But if politicians... If they only thought about the next 4 years, then we wouldn't get anywhere in this country, would we? Sometimes you need to think ahead.
Okay, well, let's hear what Marvin Rees, the Labour Mayor, has had to say last week about this congestion charge idea.
Pete Cook, you asked this question on Twitter. How can we reduce pollution from our roads without banning the poor from our cities, in brackets, those who can't afford new cars, as London's scheme does? Is it right that the poor pay and the rich play as normal? Well, Pete, I can say I appreciate your question. This is a challenge that we are really trying to navigate in Bristol. And it is actually one of the reasons we had a bit of a falling out with government over our approach to clean air. Well, there's a whole raft of things going on for us in the city at the moment around clean air, looking at a bus deal, delivering a mass transit system. We've got the City Leap program coming through, even in our own Bristol Waste Company, transitioning the vehicles over to biogas and then with new fleet coming through being electric vehicles as well. So there's a whole raft of things coming through. But one of the challenges that we faced with some of the pressure to introduce charging was that we were shown that the options that are being presented to us, beyond that, we're going to have a disproportionate impact on the lowest income people in the city. And what we've done is we said, oh, well, hold on, that's a bit of a red flag. You know, everything's on the table, but that's a red flag. We need to go and find out if there's a way we can deliver the air quality standards we need in the city that don't worsen the poverty or worsen the financial conditions of those people in the city. So, like I say, we're taking a raft of measures, but I can assure you that this is something that's of critical importance to us. There is an emergency. We have a climate emergency. And, you know, it's going to come up later, I'm sure, that, you know, all the things we're doing to meet the demands that emergency places on us as a local authority, a country and as a world. But I would say, too, the important thing we have to do in political leadership is recognising we have lots of emergencies going on right now. A housing emergency, a poverty emergency, 20% of our kids in nutrition, hunger emergency. And that is sowing the seeds for another emergency, which is this kind of rise of reactionary right-wing politics that's going on at the moment as well. So we have to make sure we're delivering on environmental justice and social justice, and the two are inseparable.
Reactionary right-wing politics. We'll be having a bit of that after the news with Nigel Farage and Alex Jones. But for the meantime, Martin, does it make sense, do you think, to have a congestion charge to bring down the levels of pollution? Because it does seem Bristol's, you know, it's a unique in a way in that we've got the M4 and the M5 encircling us. We've also got Avonmouth just upwind. You know, even if we do reduce car use in the city centre, we've still got all these other things. We can't just go up to Almondsbury and just say, well, we're shutting the motorways, can we?
Well, no, and then obviously the congestion charge in London, which was brought in by Ken Livingstone after, you know, after his effort to be being pushed out and then fought his way back in. But you've got an underground there to use. It's already in place. And of course, the answer to all of this is to have a much, much stronger lead from central government about all of this. I would argue in favour of having free public transport. just have, and we can't do that at local level. You're not allowed to. So there's no point, you know, there's no point beating up the city council for not being able to do stuff that they're not allowed to do. They're not even allowed to bring in a franchising system because that's in the hands of the extra mayor that we don't really need that the Tories foisted on us.
Okay, let's have a little look at, because we had last week the local elections, not here in Bristol, but in places like North Somerset and around the other parts of England. A bit of a disaster for the Conservatives as well. And at Prime Minister's questions, one of the questions to Theresa May was just really all about this. And one of the MPs from our own party demanding that she step down.
Andrea Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Could I say to my right honourable friend, the Prime Minister, she has tried her best. Nobody could fault or doubt her commitment and sense of duty, but she has failed. She has failed to deliver on her promises. We have lost 1,300 hard-working councillors. And sadly, the public no longer trust her to run the Brexit negotiations. Isn't it time to step aside and let someone new lead our party, our country, and the negotiations?
First of all, may I say to my honourable friend that I'm sorry that we saw so many good Conservative councillors lose their seats last week, very often for no fault of their own. I've been a councillor. I know the hard work and dedication that it takes. I've also been a councillor who has stood in an election against a difficult national background under a Conservative government, so I know what that feels like as well. And I thank all those councillors for their hard work, and I congratulate those Conservative councillors who won their seats for the first time across the country as well. Can I also say to my honourable friend, actually, this is... No, wait for it. Actually, this is not an issue about me, and it's not an issue about her. If it were an issue about me and how I vote, we would already have left the European Union.
But how exactly would we have left the European Union? I didn't notice a great clamour of people recognising the Conservative councillors, Kai, who were newly elected last week.
Must have been some retirement seats somewhere, some safe seats where people stood down.
Possibly, but you see, your Labour Party didn't do very well either, did it? And this is quite clearly some sort of, I suppose, twos up, really, from the public, saying Labour and Conservative have both failed to deliver what they said they'd do in the general election, which is Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, Labour didn't move forward. What was it, 100 seats down, was it?
80
seats down. And what were the Tories?
Thousands.
So, yes, it's not really...
I think it was 12, 13.
I think it's a bit... Yeah. It's a stretch to compare the two results, really.
Yeah. Well, the BBC were all day on Friday, weren't they? All day.
And then the parties who are claiming that success, they still came third and fourth and fifth in the election as a whole. So I don't think that's a sort of a success either. But as you say, it's about probably mainly about Brexit, but there's been some interesting results in North Somerset, for example, where independents will probably lead the council now, which could be quite interesting because it's a council that's for the last 12 years had a solid Tory majority. There's hardly any blue collar people working for the council because it's all commissioned out. So it'd be quite interesting to see how those independents, probably in coalition with Lib Dems and Labour, sort of deal with the management of the council.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. This means that the rights you currently have will be protected after the UK leaves the EU. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Bit of bad news this week for Labour as well. Tony Robinson, Martin, has quit Labour after 45 years. He's just disgusted with your local election result, particularly.
Well, I mean, if he wants to go, he can go. I mean, he was Blackadder, and I remember years ago I processed a payment that he made to War on Want when I was a volunteer at War on Want, and I processed his money for War on Want. He's got some left-wing politics, but he never liked the Corbyn Labour Party. So he's blaming
anti-Semitism and Jeremy Corbyn's leadership and duplicity on Brexit.
Well, I mean, if he wants to leave, off he goes. Bye.
Labour has been completely taken over by a leftist clique. I suppose he includes you in that clique, Martin, if he can
I'm not in any clique. Gosh, I wish I was.
After a long-standing member of the NEC was replaced by a Corbyn ally.
He lost his seat on the NEC. That's what this is about, isn't it?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I actually worked with him in London in an office at the BBC in Marylebone High Street. He was a peculiar character because at the time he was being on the TV as Baldrick and you sort of thought of him as a particular person. But when he was in the office, he was totally... You'd say good morning to him and he'd just completely ignore you, like, you know, sort of look straight through you. And he was absolutely concentrating on being very ambitious, you know, and he just, you know, he wasn't a very personable chap to have around the office on a Saturday. What do you make of this? Is this a big blow to the Labour Party, Kai?
I'm very pleased that the trade union movement's running the Labour Party again, and we've got a socialist policy platform. And if there's people out there that aren't comfortable with that, then good luck to them. That's my own opinion.
He's probably
really
going to change UK, isn't he? That's probably where he's going to end up.
There's quite a lot of people actually leaving for that now, Martin, aren't there?
This was always going to happen. I mean, the split has now occurred and people have got to decide whether they're with the Labour brand or they're not. And ultimately, I think the Labour brand will come through because of all the history that we've got.
Okay.
People making up new parties are just making stuff up.
Finally, universal credit could be scrapped, says the Bristol Post, in a trial of basic income across parts of the UK. Relying on sanctions to control individuals has been shown have damaging effects on our health. But we haven't got time, I'm afraid, to discuss that any further. It's just a bit of good news from the local paper. Thanks to our guests from the Lib Dem. For Central Ward, Kai Dudd. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll be back after the news as we spread our wings around the world. Thanks, Kai.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.